Good morning, good morning, and welcome to episode 35 of Coffee with the Coder. It's been over a year. We're so excited to share Coffee with the Coder with you. It's like a little coffee break, 10 minutes, maybe 15, and we address the questions that have been sent in from all around the country, different provider types, some students, some payers, some hospitals, some physician practices, and some inpatient rehab. And so, good morning, Paula.
Good morning.
I would like to start in Tennessee, and this is an inpatient rehab question. And it was sent from the coder to her program director and to us. And anyway, here she goes. She said that, Cindy says, I've always thought that charges for MRI and CT and surgeries of any kind were not to be on a rehab account, and they had to have a separate account. I obviously had to get this information from somewhere, but I cannot find it so that I can provide it to my rehab director, who's my source. I have one of these services on a rehab account, and I brought it to her attention, but the charges are still there. Please advise, and thank you so much. Maybe I didn't remember correctly.
Okay. All right. So basically, that's incorrect for a regular admission to the IRF. So the reason that this likely got stated, Cindy, if it did, was that these services would be bundled into the CMG payment, and they would not be separately paid. So if your patient is in the inpatient rehab facility and they have a surgery or they have some type of, you know, an MRI, you know, they go over and have an MRI and then they come back, those services are bundled in. They are not separately reimbursed. However, if the patient experienced an interrupted stay with at least one midnight out of the inpatient rehab facility, the services would be billed separately, and they would not be included in the IRF CMG. So, and I just want to verify or clarify for you that an interrupted stay is where the patient is discharged and returns back to the IRF before the expiration of three midnights. So if one of the services is performed while the patient is in the rehab, there's no separate payment. But if there is an interrupted stay and something happens during that interrupted stay, then, yes, it would be separately reported.
Thank you. Separately billed. Okay. All right. Thank you. And then now we're going to move over to Arkansas, where Joy, who's also in an inpatient rehab, has this question. If post-pay denials are incurred and are upheld, will that affect our 60%?
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Joy. Yeah, actually, Joy and I had that conversation. Yes, it could impact your 60%, although you got to recognize sometimes it does take years for a final determination on that denial. So the 60% is determined annually, but it could go back and impact that 60%. So that's one of those, another reason why you want to make sure those services are documented and billed appropriately on the front end. And then on the back end, if you did so correctly, then you can go and appeal those cases. And, you know, just to try to make sure and do everything you can to keep that reimbursement, because it could also impact your 60%.
Absolutely. Okay, so now we have an anonymous question. And those of you who are, you're certainly welcome to ask anonymous questions. We do want to provide answers for those where we can. And I want to mention that the anonymous askers do not qualify to get the In the Mugging for today. So one of our non-anonymous questioners will be winning today an official Coffee with the Coder mug, which we will mail out probably this afternoon to the address you send us. But this one, sadly, is not in the running because it's anonymous. But let's deal with the question. We had a consultant who told us that we could use a BMI between 35 and 40 for morbid obesity if their weight affected the rehab stay. And now the coders are saying it has to be 40 to be called morbid obesity. Can you give information regarding this?
Yes, absolutely. Now, here's where the coders, and this is true for inpatient rehab, it's true for physicians, it's true for hospital reporting of diagnoses. So it's any ICD-10 reporting of diagnoses. So the definition for morbid obesity changed. In our ICD-9 world, when you looked up morbid obesity in the tabular index of the ICD-9 book, it gave you a definition of a BMI of 40 or more. So the definition for morbid obesity has changed. There is no longer a requirement for the patient to meet a BMI of 40 in order to be classified as morbidly obese. You can look at, there's a document that was published by the National Institute of Health, and I know we've put that, attached that to a previous Coffee with a Coder episode, and we'll attach it to this one as well. For those of you who want to go back and listen to it and get a copy of that document, but the National Institute of Health published, it's a several-page document indicating how physicians diagnose morbid obesity, and the new rules actually, our guidelines actually say that a patient who is 35, or well, let me just say it differently, a patient who is 40, a BMI of 40, they are absolutely morbidly obese. So that's a clear-cut delineation of, yes, they're morbidly obese. However, if they're 35 or greater on the BMI, and they have certain comorbidities such as, and this is not a complete list, but such as diabetes or CAD, those patients also could be determined as morbidly obese. We're looking at the physician documentation to support that, and you definitely want to go back and review that National Institute of Health document because, yes, 35 or greater could be morbidly obese if certain other comorbidities exist.
Thank you, thank you. Well, it looks like it's going to be an inpatient rehab day because I see that my next question is from Debbie, although I've missed her state. She has a chart with a statement, diabetes, E11.9, discharge medical, blood glucose remains elevated, Levemar changed from 60 units at bedtime to 35 units in the morning, and 30, whoops, it's going off the page at me, and 30 units at bedtime, sliding scale insulin when necessary. So regarding that, she says, is it acceptable to code that as diabetes with hyperglycemia? And she found an article that seemed to address it, but she wanted to make sure it was correct due to coding guidelines. And yeah. So you had a little back and forth on that one.
Yeah, we did. Originally we answered Debbie and then went back and reviewed that question again, and I think I misinterpreted it a little bit. But as just to state, clarify, you know, we can't make a clinical decision, and this is, again, not only related to inpatient rehab, but it would be, you know, acute hospital coding, it would be physician coding, so any genre or place of service. So we can't make a clinical decision based on a physician's statement of lab values, but in her which we might need to do a query if we saw something that looked aberrant. But in Deb's statement, she said the physician stated that the glucose remains elevated. So this indicates that the physician has determined there were values that were high, meaning the patient had hyperglycemia because this was a diabetic patient. The article that she provided to us, it just basically stated that there was no, and it was prior to, the article was created prior to ICD-10 coming in, and it said, you know, there were no values associated basically or definition to define what meant hyperglycemia. But if the physician is continuing to state that the patient glucose remains elevated, that clearly defines that he or she is stating that the patient has high glucose. Now, one of the things that I would make sure is I would evaluate the glucose levels in the record because there's oftentimes that I see documentation where the physician will say one diagnosis or another, but then the clinical evidence doesn't support it. So this is more from a CDI perspective. If the physician is saying glucose remains elevated, you know, and it's, you know, 90, then that might be questionable. If it's 235, you know, you go, okay, well, you know, he's right on board with that. And even if it's going up and down across those values across the several days of admission, that may be a place for query to get, you know, both a diagnosis of hyper or hypoglycemia. Sorry. And change that to blood pressure rather than glucose. But yes, if the physician says elevated, the glucose is elevated, then yes, that would be hyperglycemia in a diabetic patient.
Thank you. Thank you. Do I have time for another one?
I think we're kind of
up.
Yeah, but I did want to just take the last few minutes, Pam, because I know that several of the questions that we had today could have been inpatient rehab facility or other types of providers. But one question that continues to come across our desk, and you know, both from consultants and people in the field as well, is related to reporting those seventh characters on patients with injuries for the etiologic diagnosis on the IRF-PI versus the principal diagnosis on the UBO4 versus the comorbidities. And I just want to speak to that again. I know we've addressed it several times, but it seems to be a lot of confusion in the industry about it. When a patient has a new injury and they come to rehab following an acute stay, if the, and I'm going to use fracture for example, if it was a fracture for example and it was a closed fracture, then our seventh character would be an A on the IRF-PI. On the UBO4, the admission or the principal diagnosis would end with the seventh character of D. And this is the most common that we see. Of course, if it's an open fracture, you're going to have a B or a C on the etiologic, on the IRF-PI, and then a D for subsequent care, basically, on the UBO4. Now, if I have multiple fractures, and some of them are comorbidities on the IRF-PI, so let's say I have a hip fracture, and then I have a vertebral fracture and a finger fracture. I'm just going to make this up. The hip fracture, the etiologic, would end with a seventh character of A, and then the comorbidities would be the vertebral fracture and the finger fracture with a seventh character of D, and that shows aftercare. If you put a seventh character of A on the IRF-PI, it appears that that condition occurred while the patient was in rehab. On the UBO4, all of the seventh characters in that situation would end with a D in most situations, and that is, this is a new acute fracture that's causing the admission. There are several other characters, seventh characters you can use, but this is the most common, and I just wanted to provide clarity of that because we've had a lot of discussion with that this past week. And I know people still have questions, so that's it, Pam.
I'm sure we all appreciate that very much. Okay, so it's time for our mugging. Someone's going to win an official Coffee with Dakota mug this morning, and it's one of these that have asked non-anonymously. So I've been, while Paul is talking on that last point, I have been stirring them up on my desk. So today's winner is Joy in Arkansas. So congratulations, Joy. We are going to be reaching out to you to find out where to mail your mug. And we are asking everyone to join us again 2 weeks from today at 10:10 on April the 30th for episode 36. Thank
hey,
you for
Pam.
Being with us. Yes?
Pam, let me
you about the webinar. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I wanted to remind everyone, you know, hey, send in some questions. We get a lot of inpatient rehab facility questions, but, you know, hey, send in some physician office questions, some hospital questions, you know, just tell us whether it's ICD-10, CPT, you know, what type of code structure it's related to, because sometimes we get those questions and it doesn't tell us, you know, what your background or your provider type is or what your type of code you're asking about, so.
True. Okay. Awesome. Well, I'll just remind you, those of you who are wanting to come to the injections and infusions webinar on Thursday, you'll find that at aq-iq.com, really close to the top. And if you do get the email back from our registrar that says, oh, by the way, you need to pay, then use code DWTC35, because this is Coffee with Dakota episode 35, and it will take $90 off, which allows the webinar to go for you for $99. And you get the one-year replay when it gets posted into the library. So since it's not going to be posted on Thursday, your year doesn't start until it posts. So that, maybe that adds just a few extra days for you. And some of you will not get the email at all. You'll just get into it because your organization is already a subscriber. So just posting that in there. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks.